Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us in the studio this morning. We have Chuk. We have Steve Chuk from Search and Rescue, and we're going to be talking with some of the volunteers, but I want you to talk to me a little bit about why this show is necessary.
Well, this show is necessary because in Southern Arizona, we really have we're really fortunate to have a group of volunteers that are willing to put in the time to train and the effort to bring their expertise to assist the Pima County Sheriff's Department in searches and rescues within our county and within the state.
I think there's a misconception, and I'm guilty myself. People think that you guys do it all, and everybody that's out there helping you when you go past a scene where there is a search and rescue, that all those people are employed with the county, and that's just not the case.
Yeah, no, that's not true at all. We'll often recognize our volunteers by the color of shirts that they wear. Like our hikers will wear yellow shirts or orange shirts. Our people on horseback will be wearing white, light blue for our dog handlers. Our divers, water. And
they wear water.
Water. And, you know, they bring their expertise in what they do to assist us, to help us accomplish the mission that we're tasked with.
Okay. On the phone, we have Mike Wilkie. And Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you.
So how long have you been with a volunteer with the Pima County Sheriff's Department?
It'll be 9 years, no, 8 years this fall, so coming up on 8 years.
And what attracted you to it?
Well, you know, I've had dogs for a long time, and I have dogs that have a lot of energy, and I don't know, just somehow it all came together that I thought this would be a good outlet for my dog's energy, and then myself, too. I'm out in the woods a lot. I know the land around here. I like to hike and that kind of thing. So just a lot of those things came together that made it a good choice.
Can you tell me what the acronym SARDI stands for?
It's Southwest Rescue Dogs Incorporated. And, you know, it might be a little bit misleading. You know, when we go to public relations events, people want to see if we want to rescue their dog, and it's like, we're not rescuing dogs.
That's what I would have thought.
Oh, I know, it's unfortunate, you know, and if we didn't have 1500 t-shirts with it on it, you know, we might think about changing it a little bit, but we gotta get through all those shirts first.
So how do you train your dog? You say your dogs have a lot of energy. What kind of dogs do you have?
Well, we have primarily right now, we have Border Collies, we have Australian Cattle Dogs, we have Australian Shepherds, we have some Belgian Malinois, and that might be it for the mix right now. Oh, no, we have a Flat-Coated Retriever also coming up, and we've had Flat-Coated Retriever in the past. So a lot of the breeds are either hunting or herding breeds, you know, breeds that you would think, you know, do a job and that kind of thing, as opposed to maybe more of a companion animal.
Do you know which one, or do you have an opinion of which one is easier to train?
Well, I would say they all probably have their challenges. You know, they all just have idiosyncratic behaviors that they can all do the job. And from what I can tell, their nose, you know, all works within a range, you know, well enough that they can do the job well. It's probably not to the level of a bloodhound, which we did have bloodhounds in our group previously. Some of those folks have phased out, so we don't have any bloodhounds, you know, that sort of traditional floppy-eared dog that you usually think of when you think of search and rescue. But, yeah, those idiosyncrasies. So, you know, some dogs might want to go after animals more if they're more of a hunting dog, per se. You know, the herding breeds, you know, I had to sort of tell my dog that, you know, even though he was bred to go after cattle, that that's not what our mission is. So
did he understand?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
Well, I don't know. You know, we're always trying to figure out what they understand. But, you know, it worked out. He doesn't go after cattle. He engages with, the task at hand. So,
What do you train them for? Are you training them to find people? Are you training them to find drugs? You know, cadavers? What do you train them for?
Yeah, so there are pretty much three different disciplines, and I guess they all revolve around finding humans, either in a living condition or a human that's no longer living. So you either sort of have a dog that follows that human's track or their trail exactly sort of where they went. So that's maybe what people would think of more traditionally for following a crook, let's say. But you could use that also for like a lost person. If you knew exactly where they left from, you could see their car and somebody said, I saw them leave their car. You could maybe follow that track or their trail or whatever. It's sort of a little bit of a nebulous term. But and then you have more of an area search where, you know someone is lost in a certain area. So you deploy the dog and they go run around. They can cover a lot more ground. And then you might have a situation where, the person's deceased, or you think they're deceased. And, so your dog can go out and find that scent, picture of a deceased, human. And, then maybe to not to get ahead, but a lot of the dogs are cross trained and, most of our dogs, the certified ones, can find a hiker who's still hiking or no longer hiking. And one of our dogs that's not quite certified yet will probably be able to track and trail and do live and cadaver work. So just takes a little more training or a lot more training.
How often do you train? Is it a daily thing that you do?
Well, I guess it's like we have our group has three official trainings a month, two on the weekends and one on a weekend or a weekday night. And then it's sort of up to the handlers to kind of know their dog and try to hit, you will hear that you're supposed to hit 16 hours a week of training, but, that's sort of not a vague term, but there's, if I'm training my dog on obedience and I'm making him stay for 10 minutes while I do stuff, I can count that as training because it's something I might ask him to do in the field. So it's not all, me having somebody hide and him go find them. So,
okay, that makes me think of something. I'll get a notice from the sheriff's department saying that a vulnerable adult is missing. Do you ever get called out on one of those where somebody's just wandered off?
Yeah, and I would actually say, my picture going into it was that I'd be hiking up on Mount Lemmon, in the cool pines. Looking for a 5-year-old kid that had wandered off from his camp. But actually, probably more often it is, the situation you described. At least maybe, half of the time, it's somebody here in the city or on the fringes of the city more often, that kind of just wandered off, maybe late at night, maybe they're elderly or compromised in some way. And, their loved ones bring it to the attention of the sheriffs and say, hey, we haven't seen this this person in a few hours and we're concerned. So, yeah, quite a few of our missions are sort of 9 o'clock at night, like, hey, let's go look for this person. So, quite a bit, actually.
And, Mike, with that being said, 9 o'clock at night, this time of year, when it's 114 out, we do have restrictions with the dogs with the weather, correct?
Oh yeah, yep. No, you guys do a good job of making sure, that it's a safe situation for the dogs. And the sheriffs always have a discussion with us. We have our picture of what the dogs can do and that kind of thing. If it's going to be the kind of thing of, can you guys go walk down this blacktop road? in the middle of the day or even late in the day, we'll probably, we'll understand that that's probably not the best situation for the dogs.
Do your dogs wear those booties on their feet?
Well, yes and no.
I've seen pictures.
I carry them, but it's more of if he injured something or if he injured his paws or something, I'd probably put them on. Dogs breathe through their feet not primarily, maybe, you know, mostly through their mouth and their tongue and that kind of thing, but their feet also do breathe. So, you know, going back to it's hot around here, it's not the best thing for them. I mean, maybe for short periods, or if you knew you were going into an area that, or you thought, you know, there might be, I don't know, just a lot of broken glass or something, and you wanted to get through an area, you could do that. But we train with it. We, you know, we make sure that they're comfortable enough with their boots that they'll still, you know, do their job. But in general, you know, we're not going to use the boots sort of as a way to get out there and push the dog further than kind of what's a good idea.
Do you train in the house or out of the house or both?
Both, for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Just curious.
No, okay. We train in buildings and out too. I mean, yeah, our weekday night ones are usually an urban thing. You know, people are working, so we just find something in town. We've gone to parking garages. We've gone to storage facilities. We've gone, you know, we try to expose the dogs to many, many situations so that, you know, if they're called out for that kind of thing, you know, they're not scratching their head saying, boy, this is really a weird situation. We've gone to junkyards. We've gone to the airport. So anyway, yeah, we along the railroad tracks.
So yeah. If somebody's interested in being a part of your organization, what do they do? Who do they contact?
We have, there's a website you can kind of take a look at, and that either might get you excited or rule it out for you, but Southwest Rescue Dogs.org. There's an email address, canine, like the letter K and the number 9, at sarcy2.org. It's, you'll learn about Sarcy a little bit later, but Southern Arizona Rescue Council Incorporated. They can shoot us an email. Right now, we've got we have about 15 members, about 12 active, 6 that are certified with dogs, and we've got a bunch coming up. So right now, we're not taking on a whole lot more work, especially with this COVID thing. We've had to rearrange training and that kind of thing. So I do appreciate people's interest, but I have to say, you know, right now we're kind of maintaining.
Just, yeah, I get that. Okay, I appreciate you calling in, Mike, and teaching us what's going on, and I appreciate all your volunteer work.
Wonderful. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Mike. Good job.
Yep. All right.
Okay, next on the phone is Colleen. Colleen, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi.
I certainly can. Thank you for having us on.
Oh, I think this is awesome. I'm just so intrigued with search and rescue and all you people who volunteer your time and your effort and your knowledge. Tell me what attracted you to do what you're doing, and which part of it are you doing?
Well, I am with Southern Arizona Mounted Search and Rescue, and I've been doing it since about 2006. And I got interested. We had a gentleman at the place where I boarded my horses, and he did search and rescue, and he approached us and asked if we wanted to join myself and another friend. And I thought, you know, this is a wonderful way to give back to the community with an animal that you have to serve.
That's very true. So give me a typical call out for you. You know, we need mounted patrol. What do you usually do? Where do you usually go? Because you're not like the dog that can sniff things out. You have a horse.
No, that's right. Absolutely. We usually get deployed by the deputies when there is an injured patient that needs to be hauled out. A lot of places, I think 80% of our call-outs have been in the Seven Falls, Sabino Canyon area, where it gets a little bit on the rocky side and difficult for a Stokes basket to, you know, for a patient to be placed on a Stokes basket and be hauled in and out. We do Sorrel Park East and Sorrel Park West. Some of the trails that are up in the mountains, they have, you know, deteriorated to the point where it's not safe for, you know, equine to go up there. So we go in and we will haul injured patients out of the field. We will actually haul equipment in, whatever they need, oxygen tanks, extra water, IV fluids, rope bags we've been deployed to do. And there have been actual searches where we are searching for someone that's out in the desert area. And we have several members, and we do our line searches, and we will, you know, search our quadrant and our grid and help them in that way.
You said basket. Would you put somebody in a basket on a horse?
Southern Arizona Rescue Association, like Seven Falls, we can only go so far. Then it gets way too dangerous for horses, too many rocks, too many step downs. So they will bring the patient to us in what's called a Stokes basket, and it's a basket with a big giant wheel on it. It takes approximately 8 people to man that wheel. They will bring that patient down to us to a turnaround, what we call the horse turnaround, and then we will unload the patient from the Stokes basket and then safely mount the patient on the horse and then walk him out on the horse.
Okay. Do you have a picture of that that we can post on her? Because my head isn't wrapping around this.
Absolutely. Okay. Yes, we can send you many pictures.
Okay. I want to see it. I do want to see it. Sheriff Napier is on the phone. Sheriff, how you doing?
I'm doing good, my friend. I'm just on one thing to another. I've realized that sheriffs get to work 7 days a week, which is a great thing, but I just wanted to take a minute and give a shout-out to these great people. They work so well with our department, and truly, every year, we save hundreds of lives, and that's not hype. That's reality. We have so many people that engage in risky hiking behavior or even really not very smart hiking behavior and end up needing to be rescued, and these people go out and risk their lives as volunteers to save lives, and I couldn't be any more proud of our relationship with them.
Now they're doing some amazing things, and I'm just fascinated by some of the things I'm learning this morning. I knew we had them because I've had search and rescue on before, but I've never had the opportunity to speak with them. That's why I'm like, okay, tell me the stuff you know. I want to know it all.
Yeah, it's just great that we have this relationship that, you know, you always talk about the things that aren't so good, but these are things that are really saving lives. And it still amazes me with all the information out there that probably today somebody will be sitting around at 10:30 and say, you know, I think I'll go for a hike. That's okay because I've got a 16-ounce bottle of water. I mean, it's amazing that people still do these things, but they do. And we're fortunate to have people that can help us go out there and save these lives.
Absolutely. Even with their horse, it fascinates me. I appreciate it. Do you ride a horse?
I used to. I was a kid growing up in the farmlands of Iowa. I could ride out into the field, but that was about it.
Okay. I was going to volunteer you for this group.
So, all right.
Thanks for calling in.
Sherry, and thanks to all those folks.
Thank you. So, Colleen, the stuff that you need to do your job when you're, you know, on this search and rescue, do you pay for all that yourself, or are things donated to you? How does that work?
Everything that we have is basically on our own dime. We pay for everything that we have, our trucks, our trailers, our equipment, medical equipment, everything. When we run out of funds or when we see that we need to buy new equipment, like recently we had to buy several new radios, and, you know, those get pretty expensive.
Yes.
Well, we had a golf tournament that we did that we raised funds for that purpose. And we do get occasional donations, but mostly it's a fundraise that we do, and we pay for everything ourselves.
So even like first aid, you were talking about helping people administering first aid. Do you take donations for, you know, first aid type things, bandages, gauze, whatever?
Yes, ma'am. We will take donations for anything. We very much appreciate those types of donations because we do go through them occasionally. So, you know, any donation, money, equipment, you know, bandages, those types of things. Yes, we definitely would appreciate. Thank you.
That's awesome. So if somebody wants to get involved with the mounted search and rescue, how do they go about it?
Well, they can we have a website, www.samsarz.org. There's a lot of information on there about contacting us, and there is a email address to contact one of our people. Then also, like Mike mentioned, on sarsi.org, there's a way that you can click on the tab for SAMSAR, and it'll send you to the email address to contact us with. And we have a Facebook page also, SAMSAR, Southern Arizona Mounted Search and Rescue on Facebook, and I get contacted through there quite often.
So if somebody does want to be involved, You know, they can't go out and just buy a horse and be a newbie at this. They have to have some basic knowledge about what you guys are doing and how you go about it. Like if I ran out and bought a horse, I don't think you'd accept me.
Oh, absolutely. The requirements would be we have to have our candidates need to have a truck and a trailer and a horse and tack. And what we'll do is we'll invite them to come meet to a meeting, and we'll, you know, interview them, talk to them, find out what their experiences are. We look for a good team. You know, we want a horse and rider team with, you know, some experience. You know, we're looking for the team that is not going to, you know, where the handler, the rider, we want someone who's going to be able to say, you know what, I can't do heights. I don't want to go in the mountain because I'm afraid of heights. That's the type of person that we're looking for, because when we get deployed by the Sheriff's Department, you know, we maintain safety at all times. So we want to make sure that we're not going to put anyone in danger, whether it be the horse, the rider, or the patient that we're carrying out, or the people that are surrounding us. So we want to make sure that we always have, you know, a good team and a good product out there. So we'll do several rides with the people. We all go out and do different trail rides and different terrains. We'll start them off flat. We'll, you know, run our horses behind them to make sure that the horse isn't a kicker. And if it is, the person needs to know, hey, my horse is a kicker. Full disclosure on how your horse is, because every horse has different idiosyncrasies. One that, you know, won't like you to come up behind them. I have a gelding that doesn't like it if you hand him equipment on the right side, but yet he'll take it on the left side. You know, so what we need is someone who knows the horse backwards and forwards like the back of their hand, and that the horse trusts the rider and the rider trusts the horse. And you get that by experience and, you know, being with your horse and riding it a lot.
So how do you train for what you do?
Well, me personally, and I know the members in our group, we'll ride in all different areas and terrains and different scenery and obstacles. I ride my horse to Starbucks down Broadway and Houghton Road, and you know, so he gets exposed to equipment. We have trainings with our component groups, like with Southern Arizona Rescue Association. We'll bring everybody into an arena, and we'll have them bring out their equipment, such as the Stokes basket, and we'll have the Stokes basket, you know, go around all the different horses and you know, work with them so that the horses get exposed to it. The same with the equipment bags. We'll bring the actual emergency vehicle, like one of the deputies will bring their truck into the arena, and with the lights and sirens, and we get them used to all that kind of stuff. You know, we expose them to everything. We're constantly doing that. Every time we're riding, whether it's just a fun trail ride, I'm always testing my horse to see if he'll do this, do something, climb up on a rock, you know, or go down a steep hill. You know, we're always training. You're always doing that.
Yeah, you just named a bunch of things I wouldn't even have thought of. But, you know, you're right. Yeah. The horse has to be used to everything.
Everything, yes. We had a horse one time that when we were doing some training, I was pretended to be a patient, and so they put a orange SAM splint on my leg. Well, they went to mount me on the horse because we were practicing mounting, and the horse didn't like the orange SAM splint. Well, we turned it inside out and put the blue one on, and he let me get on.
Well, there you go. He doesn't like orange. I don't either.
I know. I don't like it either. Orange is not my color.
That's interesting, because each horse has its own personality. I've never owned a horse, but I've got a friend that has a whole flock of them. And it's interesting how they take care of their horses and their personalities. Each one is different.
Yes. Absolutely. They most certainly are. Yes.
Well, I appreciate everything that you do. I'm fascinated. I know I couldn't do what you do, so I appreciate you being out there and helping.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity of getting us out there to educate the public on what we do. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. And our next caller is Joe Barr. And what does Joe do? Joe, tell me what you do.
Hello there. Hi. I'm a member of the Search Recovery Dive Team, also a member of SARA, but I'm here talking about the divers at the moment.
So Steve told me you wear wet.
So. Yeah, we wear water. So I guess our uniform color is typically black rubber, because we'll wear wetsuits even in this weather, because you get more than a couple of feet deep in the local lakes, cattle ponds, or whatever, and it gets wicked ice cream headache cold down there. So we're always wearing full wetsuits.
So what is your background? Were you in the military?
No, I wasn't. I've been a volunteer for about 47 years, a search and rescue volunteer. And I'd started out with the ground team and joined the divers later. So a lot of people are members of more than one team where they can sort of, you know, work with their specialty, if you will, of the individual team. So I work with both Sarah and the dive team.
So what made you want to become a diver? And where did you get trained?
Well, I learned to dive when my father and his friends were diving long ago, and they'd come to the beach and leave their gear, and the kids would go out and start to learn how to use it, which is not the recommended way. But eventually got certified and was diving for pleasure. I actually met my wife underwater, for that matter. yes, that's a whole other story. But as all of these teams work closely together, I was being exposed to the dive team, and so I joined that. It's probably been 25, 30 years ago or something, and have worked with them ever since as well.
Okay, tell me a typical, you're going to be called out because they need a diver. What is the situation? What's the scenario?
Well, something underwater that you want to get back. It could be...
Like evidence?
It could be evidence. It could be a person that's drowned, which is most unfortunate, but you'd like to get them back and provide closure and whatnot. Might be a vehicle that you want to get out of the water, and it might be evidence in itself. So we go out and we do a lot of planning, and we do typically look at things with sonar. We have some side scan sonar.
Hey Joe.
Yeah,
you're talking about sonar. Why don't you talk about the visibility in these water situations you guys are working in?
Good point. Yeah, or lack of. It's really black water, and I like to describe a search pattern I did in Patagonia where I could see a foot or two with my bright dive light, and I turned at the end of the pattern. We're following a rope underwater. And I thought my dive light went out when I swam into the cloud that I had stirred up, but it turned out it was just not visible at all at arm's length pointing at my face. It was that murky.
So a lot of your work is done just by feel, right? But you guys do have landline communication to the surface, correct?
Yeah, we have a radio or ultrasound radio to the surface, so we can talk to the surface. But almost all of our searching is tactile by feel. And so we don't move very fast, and it takes a long time to cover an area because we are the equivalent of just crawling along and sweeping our hands and searching for something relatively small in a lot of cases. And so it's a slow process.
So what was the last thing that you found underwater that you were sent out to do?
A piece of evidence. It was a weapon, and we had an approximate area we thought it was in, and that's too small to be picked up on our sonar, so that really doesn't help. So we just run search patterns underwater. We lay down rope systems that give us something to follow because there's just no orientation down there in black water. You can't follow a compass or anything.
Wow.
And you just go back and forth on these rope lines and until we feel it, and then we stop and we'll bring it to the surface after they come out and get a location on where we are. Hand it to a deputy, and they take it from there.
On a typical dive, Joe, how many people does it take to run that mission?
It takes, at a bare minimum, it takes like 6 or 8 people, but really we need a dozen or more. And it's kind of neat because we're involved with all of these teams that you're hearing about today, and they will come out and support their sister organizations. So when we need more manpower, we just heard from Colleen. She'll be out there helping us with what we need to do, along with a number of other people in these organizations. So It's just awesome the way these groups work together and help each other.
So actually you have backup. They might not be able to dive, but they're on the surface helping you with what you need to get your job done.
That's exactly right, because there's a lot of things that are needed on the surface, whether it's communications, logging, tending lines, laying search patterns down. And so we use any help we can get from these other teams. They've worked with us, they've trained with us, they know what we're doing. And so they come out and let us do the sonar work and the diving while they take care of a lot of the other effort on the surface.
And when we talk about diving, we've got a team that's dedicated to be in the water, going after the evidence, but we also have a backup dive team in case something goes wrong. That's our safety team that goes in and can conduct a rescue on a rescuer, correct?
That's right, Steve, and that's one of the reasons it takes so many people is besides the one or two divers we might have deployed on a search pattern, we will have another diver and a support crew on the surface, and they will be ready to step into the water in 30 seconds if necessary, if someone needs some help. So we're really running two parallel crews, if you will, in that scenario. And so we'll do that anytime we have a diver out there.
Do you never dive by yourself, do you?
No, I mean, we don't dive without a team to support us. Now, I might be the only diver in the water at the moment, but I am on a tether line to the surface, and there's a line tender on the other end that I can communicate with by radio, or I can communicate with by signals on the rope, which we always used to use before we had the radio, so we're proficient at that. And then there's a whole other team of diver and support personnel that is ready to step into the water at a moment's notice if I need another pair of hands or if I have some difficulty or whatever. So I'm really not alone, even if I'm the only diver in the water.
So that's what Colleen was talking about, cross-training. I mean, you know, she's mounted, but she can also help assist on land with you being in the water. And you have
Absolutely.
A whole group of people can do that.
Yes, and then we're very happy to see Colleen and the others come out when we have some missions, because we know we need the extra help.
Absolutely. So if somebody wants to get involved with your portion of the search and rescue, how would they do it, and who would they contact?
Okay, well, we've got a website, and I'll just refer to sarci.org, sarci.org. All of the groups, there's a link there to all of these teams and contact information. For us, it's divers@sarci.org, but that can all be found on that website. And we are interested in new members. We want people to have at least an advanced open water and significant experience, so they're comfortable in the water. This is not something for the faint of heart. It doesn't work for everybody. Groping around in black water is not it's not sport diving. It's not fun.
Yeah.
But then we'll get some public safety diving certifications for them as well, because that's what we require for our active divers.
And where do they do that? In town?
Any of the dive shops can get them their dive certifications up to advanced open water, and many people have that already. The public safety diving is available in town. We have some instructors in the group, so we'll coordinate that once they join up.
And again, our divers are a resource that are used statewide. So we've recovered vehicles out of the town lake down in Sorita. We've done recoveries for Cochise County for vehicles in cow ponds and things of that nature. So we really can't say enough about how fortunate we are here with the resources that we have available.
How often do you get called out for a dive rescue or situation?
Not very often. I'd say on the average it might be a couple times a year, but still we train pretty much every month. We haven't trained in the last few months because of the COVID issues, but Our normal routine is we train every month, so we stay very proficient at it.
So where do you train?
We start out, our training program starts in shallow, clear water. So we'll start in pools, and we'll work into deeper water, maybe out to the CAP reservoir, and then into shallow lakes, and then the deeper and darker water as we progress through the
Do you have program. To schedule those trainings, or do you just go out someplace and start training, and people are looking at you going, huh?
Yeah, no. For the most part, we have to schedule them, and sometimes a long time in advance. But we have our training schedule, our training days are well set. So we have a year-long training schedule typically laid out. And yes, we have to schedule pools. We have to schedule the CAP facility.
What's CAP?
The Central Arizona Canal.
Oh.
We occasionally do searches there. And they have a reservoir southwest of town. It's a good training site. It's fairly deep, but still fairly clear water. So it's a good transition from pools to lakes.
So are you cross-trained into a different area as well?
Cross-trained as in, I mean, I'm a member of SARA as well. So I work with that organization and have for decades.
Yeah, well, Joe has, with our hiking component, with the dive team, he helps in management situations. If we've got a large search and we have communication issues or documenting things, a lot of different capacities. Our volunteers wear a lot of different hats.
It sounds like it, yeah.
And again, the Sheriff's Department could not do what we do and have the success that we have without our volunteers, for sure.
Tell us about, you told me a story last week when you pulled up to a rescue scene. Tell me what the spectator, a civilian, said to you.
Well, a lot of our trailheads and stuff are like, come up from neighborhoods, like if you're at Finger Rock or Ventana or Agua Caliente. And we had a particular rescue where we were going after an individual that had fallen and had a head injury, and we figured that we'd be flying this individual out because of the injury. So I was going to the call rather early in the morning, and I was driving through the neighborhood a little bit quicker than most people would like. And I didn't have my siren going because I didn't want to wake everybody up that's in their neighborhood. And a cyclist didn't seem to like the fact that that had occurred. So he came back to me as I was trying to throw things into my backpack and get on a trail to tell me pretty much what he thought of how I was conducting myself and the fact that there were so many first responders already at the trailhead. What this individual didn't realize were the first responders that were at the trailhead were firefighters that were not going to be orchestrating helicopter extrication of this patient from the field. And that's something that I needed to get in the field so I could do that portion of the job. We were able to get that individual in the helicopter and fly him out. He spent a couple days in the hospital with a head bleed. And we were told that it was very fortunate that he was to the hospital in a timely manner.
Otherwise, it could be a different
result. Correct. But,
result.
You know, the citizen that wanted to tell me what he thought about how I was conducting my job had every right to do so, and I respect that, but he really didn't understand the full magnitude of what
was
we
going
needed
on.
To do. Correct.
Yeah, you were the rescuer. You know, first responders were there, but you were the rescuer.
In that particular situation, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's why I'm so glad we're doing this show, because I don't think people, the average citizen, myself included, realizes just, number one, how many people it takes to, you know, somebody goes hiking, they get injured, how many people it really takes to get that person to...
Well, as you listen to Joe and Colleen and Mike, they talk about helping each other out.
Mm-hmm.
SARCI is the organization that they're all members of, they all work under, but we're all one team. And our mission is to be successful at what we do. And we have to do it with all the components. And when we're working a search or a rescue, we'll make the phone call to the dog team or to the horse team and see if this is a mission that they can assist on, if they're capable of doing what they can do. And if they're not, because of weather restrictions or, like Colleen said, too rocky a terrain for the horses or whatever, then we have to make our plan without that component. But that doesn't mean that those individuals won't come and assist in another way, whether it's with communication or just getting other supplies to our people or whatever. So it's a great family that we work with.
So everybody knows everybody and what their capacities are.
Correct.
Very cool. Joe?
Yes.
Hi. We're just talking amongst ourselves.
Thanks, Joe.
I want to thank you for calling in and being a part of this and educating me. I appreciate everything you do.
Thank you, Sherry. I appreciate it.
Okay. On the phone, we have Brooke. And what is... Brooke, how are you?
Hello.
Hi. What is your function with this organization?
So I'm with Southern Arizona Rescue Association, and we are what you would consider, now that you've talked to the dogs and the horses and the divers, we're the boots group of SARC, and we're the teams that would be deployed out into the field with packs and equipment to do search or rescue, various things. So we're the hiking side.
So you actually know the terrain like the back of your hand.
We like to. When we do have people who want to join, that is one thing that we ask. How well do you know the trails in this area? Certainly we get a lot of people with a lot of hiking experience in other areas, which is also great. But we really encourage people when they come to us and say, hey, you know, I want to join, what would it take? And we really encourage them to get out, explore, especially the Catalinas, but also Rincon's, Tucson, and Santa Rita's.
Okay, the Catalinas, that's a huge mountain range, and every little chunk of it has a different name. So, I mean, it's like, I didn't realize that until I met, you know, Steve. I was just wondering, when somebody, do you have particular areas that you prefer to go into, or are there certain areas that are more risky than others?
So for one, you can go from one end of the Catalinas to the other walking. So,
how long does that take?
I guess it would depend on who you are, but it is something to consider when we have somebody who's missing and, you know, Deputy Chook might get a call that says, my sister started her hike and she was planning to go to Merrill Pools and, you know, do this, that, and the other. And, you know, your search always starts where they were intended to go, but it often will expand out and we will find people who've gotten turned around and been able to make it to areas they had not intended to go, even on trail. So that's why I bring that up, because it's just so many trails up there. I don't think people realize, which is great. It's a great resource. It's only a 40-minute drive to be able to get out and get exercise and explore the wilderness. But it is a vast web of trails, and they go to all different parts, like you said. I think there wouldn't be any place that comes to mind readily that's more dangerous than another. Certainly, I think what we've seen and what we'll probably be facing again when the trails open up this year is when there are large fires, it obliterates the trail. People get turned around pretty easily. And any kind of monsoon or rain activity doesn't help the situation at all. So your trail gets even more obliterated. So even though you think that you kind of remember this trail, you can lose it pretty easily.
Yeah, because the fire kind of changes the everything. In fact, you know, we are sometimes this year, maybe we might have a monsoon. And if that ever happens, what kind of precautions do you think people need to take?
So one area that's, I think, our biggest concern during monsoon season is Tankerford Canyon. I would say it's probably a big concern area year-round. When there's any kind of water in it, it's easy to reach. It's easy to reach with just limited hiking capabilities, six pack of beer. So there's a lot of party activity that can go on down there. That tends to be a lot of our rescues when there's water down there. But the other aspect of Tankaverde Canyon that takes up the rest of our, I guess, like statistics in that area is during monsoon season. In our canyons here down that we see and we love here on the like city side, they all go up to the top of the mountain. So everything that's happening at the top of the mountain, whether you see the clouds or not, is going to come down. We've had several
water
rescues and flash floods. There's not a good way to say, because I think it comes up a lot, maybe every year, there's not a good way to say, let's put in some sort of alert system, because what happens way up on Green Mountain, which is quite a distance and a long drive away, will affect Tankaverde Canyons and Bear Canyon and the places that everybody loves to go during the summer monsoon season. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is, I think people see, okay, there's water in the canyon. I'm just going to get out of this heat. I'm going to cool off. It's really hot. It's really humid. People really need to be careful taking enough water. You know, your monster drinks and energy drinks does not actually count. We really want people to have water and, if possible, any kind of Noom or Gatorade. Or I know a lot of people don't want to drink Gatorade because it has sugar in it or because of whatever. But something to consider is how much calories you're burning when you're hiking. I don't think people really understand they're really burning a lot of calories. They're going to be able to make up the difference easily if they are drinking something like a Gatorade or a Propel, something that puts those electrolytes back into them. So that would probably be our third category of high activity is the dehydration we see. Yes, in June and upcoming into monsoon season, but definitely once we hit monsoon season because people are out trying to enjoy the water.
So the biggest thing is dehydration. People can get disoriented as well. If you're dehydrated, you can be nauseated and just, not feeling well.
Exactly. And I would say, in a lot of places, and when you see things on Facebook that say, here's what to do if you for heat illness, and they wait a few steps before calling 911. When we post anything on our Facebook page or when we talk to the public about dehydration, we move that 911 call up. It's extreme heat here, and you can quickly go south for people. So we always say, at the first sign of heat illness, find some shade, sit down. Some of our members who've been around for a really long time like to remind people, eventually the sun does go down. So if you just need to sit and wait for the sun to pass to a point where it's not just beating on you, get some water, some electrolytes, eat something, refill your body with some fuel, and just wait. There's no reason to push yourself. And if you feel that for any reason, you might be going downhill. Like you start to feel that nausea, you start to feel dizziness, you're clammy. Any of those things, it's time to call 911 because in wilderness settings especially, and depending on how active that person is, it might take us a while to get in there to them. Like I said, though, most often it's in our lower canyon areas like Seven Falls and Tankaverde Falls. So that is easier, a little bit easier to get to people. And I think that's one thing, though, that's important to remember.
When you go hiking or when you're out there and you're not on a call, do you wear the, what color shirt are they, blue?
The orange.
Oh, orange. So for us, we're orange, yeah.
Do you always wear your orange shirt?
You know, you bring up a really great point. We don't. however, as our, you know, we're a 501c3, and so we provide a lot of education out in the community. We do a lot of events out in the community. And one of the things that we do that I think is one of the more important things that we do, aside from being a resource for Pima County, is our, we call it PSAR. So it's our pre-SAR, meaning we're going to try to talk to you before things go downhill. So we will, throughout the summer, station ourselves at trailheads that we know have a lot of activity. Those are our low canyon trails, which are, you know, the Romero with water. So it's Romero Pools, Tank Verde Falls, and
trying to educate people before they get in trouble.
Well, we pass out Gatorade and water, and we catch a lot of people going in and we catch a lot of people coming out, and we're really glad to be there to do that. If you are in any way, especially coming out of, you know, Seven Falls, if you're in any way feeling a little bit dizzy or a little bit you're too hot, overheated, tired, you know, at that trailhead, you're not done yet. You still have to walk all the way out to your car.
Brooke.
So we get a lot of grateful people taking our Gatorade at that point.
Brooke, have you ever been on Seven Falls Trail going in on a rescue and come across another person that was in need of your assistance?
Yes. So that actually happens quite a bit, especially in the summertime.
What do they need?
They need water and Gatorade. And that is our typical needs. We pass out a lot of water and Gatorade on our way in, as well as managing patient care once we get to the person who has called. Is that what you're leading to?
Absolutely. And a lot of times we're talking to these people as they're going in and they're walking past that last water spigot at Seven Falls, and we're begging them to fill up their water bottles, and they just keep going, right? They just don't want to heed our warning.
And I think when you are that hot, your mission is just to get the heck out of there. Like, just think about the end of a long, frustrating day at work, the end of, you know, shopping with your four-year-old, the end of anything that is, you know, frustrating and taxing on your body and your brain. You just want to get the heck out of there. And I think it gives people this tunnel vision of, I don't want anything. I just want to get the heck out of here. I just want to get to my car. And it is sometimes really hard to get them to see what we're seeing. We're seeing signs and symptoms so clearly. So, you know, if you're thinking like that, if you're thinking, I just want to get out of this situation, you know, please pause for a moment. Think about other resources and things that you might need in order to actually do get out of that situation a little more safely.
So you want people to prepare before they go walking into a hiking trail or trying to, you know, get that outdoor experience. A novice like myself would probably not know what to carry. So I would go to your website and check it out. There's everything on there. I was reading it over the weekend. Everything on there is something that you need to consider, not just, oh, I don't need that, move on to the next.
Can you give the website one more time, Brooke?
Sure. It is www.sarcy, which is S as in Sam, A-R, C as in cat, I.org.
And do you... go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you make a really good point, though, about just being prepared in general, because right now, of course, it's summer. We're very worried about dehydration, although the mountain is the...
30 seconds.
But there's also winter time as well. And, you know, we do live in a desert area, and we have... deep drops in the evening. So we really recommend that in the winter, as well as in the buffer, like spring and fall, people bring their lights and bring their jackets, because everything falls very quickly.
Very true. And I want to thank you for everything you do. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. And until next week, I want everybody's...
Thanks, Brooke.
Shop local, stay safe, stay tuned. Law Matters Live Show airs Saturday mornings at 8 when our listeners ask questions of people who have answers. On our next show, journalist Chuck Holton talks about his coverage of the riots, and attorney Mike Stories explains the rights of law enforcement. This is your show, Arizona, so get your questions ready to join the talk at 790-2040. You don't want to be left out. Set your alarm for AM 1030 The Voice. And we can't do the show without your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute.